How long have you lived in Greer?
I started teaching in 1939. I taught 2 years in my hometown of Manning, South Carolina. And then I went to Rock Hill and taught there for 2 years. Got married to war. The war was, everybody was in the war. And my husband was in the Navy. And when I married him, I lost my job because they didn't employ married female teachers. That was very common. Then I was married at Christmas, and I lost my job. So I went to work for the War Price and Rationing Board, and then I stayed home with my children. I had 4 children, kind of widely separated, and we came to Greer in 1952. My husband came up. He was working for the federal government. His office was in Greenville. And he wanted me to stay home with the children. But I wanted to teach because I loved it. And I went back in 1960 and stayed at Greer High School until I left in I retired in 1979. So I've been in education. I then decided I wanted to see what it was really like to be in the classroom again, so I substituted. After I retired, I substituted for 5 years and thoroughly enjoyed it and would have kept right on, but he had a cancer diagnosis and I had to quit.
What was your favorite part about teaching?
I love the young people. Now, not middle school. I never wanted to teach middle school, but I can truthfully say that I looked forward to every day that I went to school. I still have contacts with some of my former students, and I just loved them. And I used to tell their parents when the parents were so upset about certain things, you know, you don't judge children, people, between the ages of 14 and 18. If you're ever going to be foolish, you'll be foolish those years. And so I encouraged parents to hang in there with them, love them, fuss at them when you needed it, but just hang it, just be there. And most of the time it worked. During the drug years, what I call the drug years, the 1970s, it was tough. Lots of children tried drugs for the first time, not knowing that sometimes you can do it one time and you are hooked. So we had some sad situations during those years. But that was what I liked. I liked dealing with the children. And I was a counselor after I... eventually, my principal kept telling me he wanted me to get a degree in counseling, and he wanted me to be a counselor. And so from 1968 until I left in 79, I was head of the guidance department. And I did not like the paper shuffling that we did, so I didn't do it. I talked to children and teachers and parents all day and stayed at school in the afternoon and did the paperwork or either brought it home and did it. My idea of counseling is you can take all the data that you want to and put down, but you're not going to know much about the child until you deal directly with the child. And that's what I liked.
Now, what did you teach before you were guidance
counselor? Well, my favorite subject, American history. United States history. I taught some related social studies subjects. I taught economics. I taught world geography. Because seldom could you get a teacher teaching the same thing all day. And then I taught an advanced placement class in Western civilization. I did that for about 3 years when I was part-time teacher and part-time guidance. But I love American history, and I believe that every child should know it, the ins and the outs. I used to give them questions that made them think. As, for example, suppose the western coast of the United States had been developed earlier than the east. What do you think our country would have been like? Would we have eventually had the whole country, because they had the Rocky Mountains to get it through? And we had, our mountains were much, much smaller. But I just love the subject myself. Economics, I thought was so necessary for children. I was brought up during the Depression. It was so necessary for children to know something about how our economy works and how you save and prepare yourself for the things that you want out of your life. One of my pet projects was to tell them, say, suppose you go, boys and girls in 11th and 12th grades, you know, always have girlfriends and boyfriends. Suppose you got married. Both of you have minimum wage jobs. I want you to go out and find me a place where you can live and pay the rent, a place of some transportation. You're going to have it. And I want you to figure out a budget for yourself. And then I would come in with about, suppose your wife is pregnant. Then what do you do? It's such a practical subject. And I liked teaching that.
Something you mentioned a moment ago, the AP classes, the advanced placement classes, how long have they been around?
I had the first one at our school, and that was in 1964. I believe it was in 64 or 65. I was the head of the social studies department. I was not supposed to teach that class. The teacher who was to teach it had been working with me all summer on materials, but she was going to be the teacher because she was she taught world history, and she developed cancer about the time that we had our in-service before school opened, and 3 weeks later she was dead, and the principal just simply told me that I had to teach it. And I nearly killed myself studying that year because I was really not prepared for it. But one of my students he made the score to get in, and I was proud of that. But that's how long they've been around. Now, they have been in other schools before that, and we worked hard to get the course. And it is a shame that it had to be taught by somebody who was ill-prepared to teach it, because I was, you know, and I knew, but I was accommodating. So I read history till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning and developed high blood pressure.
You were the head of the social studies department.
Yes.
Was it difficult for you as a woman to get into a leadership position like that?
No. We had several men in the department. And to be honest and truthful about it, most of the men in the social studies department were also connected with athletics, because that's what they get, you know, a coach with the social studies. And they didn't much care what we did as long as we didn't bother them. That's not to say that they were not effective teachers. It's simply to say that they didn't challenge what we did. And we worked very well together. I want to say something right there. I worked at Greer High School for 19 years, not counting the substitution years. And I have never had a student be disrespectful to me. I never had a colleague. I never had a conflict with a colleague. I did have a principal whose ethics I did not like. And I simply went to the people ahead of him, because we had area offices then. We had four area offices in Greenville County, and this was the northeast area. And I went to the head of the northeast area, and I said, I will talk with you and this principal, but I will tell you, if we can't come to some conclusion, whereas he is not here, I will not be back. And so what they did was promote him. They promoted him to the area office, but he didn't stay with us long. The guidance counselor works very closely with administration. The guidance counselor knows what administration is doing and knows if any partiality is shown and if anything is unfair. And I couldn't handle that. I had to trust my principal, and fortunately, well, I had good principals. We worked well together. I had a good time teaching.
You were teaching during the time that the schools were first integrated, correct?
Yes.
What was that like?
From the standpoint of school authorities, strongest emotion was fear, but it was not fear of anything physical. It was the fear of uncertainty. This was new. There was a lot of uncertainty about how it was going to work out. There was a lot of pessimism that it won't work. The high school from which we received our black students was Lincoln High School, which was later made into Foothills Vocational School. And now I don't know what that building is used for. But we integrated without any real difficulty. We had a lot of adjustments, but we never had riots. We never had extreme vandalism. We had a human relations committee, and it was equally white and black. It had co-sponsors. I was the white co-sponsor, and Betty Golden, who was a first-class PE teacher at the time and later counselor, was the black. We have lunch together once a month now. She was very young. She was just out of college when she came to us, and she likes to tell people that I taught her all she knew. But what we did, we would talk in the afternoons about everything that happened that day, and she talked freely, and so did I. And we also had, at the time, student council. We had a leader in the student council who was super. She was a real leader. And if she heard, and she would hear this, there was going to be a brouhaha after school or at lunchtime. She came immediately to me, and Ms. Golden and I talked about it. and talked about what we would do, could do to prevent it, and then we set her out, and then she was so good herself at dealing with the youngsters. The blacks liked her, and so we didn't really have any trouble. The chief problem was the gap in academic achievement. Apparently, they had been very lax at Lakeland High School, and children had been promoted who had been absent 103 days. And see, I had the records, so I knew all this. And students who made all A's, who, you know, it was, and we had a former teacher at Lincoln who was a member of our faculty and a very fine member of our faculty. And I asked her one day, I didn't talk about this to the teachers, but I have talked to her. And I said, how did this happen? The records were so incomplete and so confusing, and we were so particular about records. And she said, Mary, we didn't have any leadership. The black leadership was poor, and I asked her why, and she said, they gave up. They just gave up. And I think that probably was true in a lot of schools. But we worked through that. We still have a gap in achievement between blacks and whites, but it's cultural. We hired a counselor with wonderful credentials from Connecticut, and when he came to the school, I said, the first thing I want to do with you is drive you around Greer and let you see where your students are going to come from. And when I drove through the black section, I said, now, the black section in Greer is, not more than four blocks from what was then the high school, which was right on North Main Street. And I would say, these children come from these homes. And in the afternoon, they go back to these homes. And this is the community that they live in. It's sad. It was sad, but it was, he needed to understand. It wasn't like it was in Connecticut. And he later became one of Greenville County's prime principals. So far as behavior was concerned, I used to talk to the black girls after school, and I would stay at school till 6 or 7 o'clock. I would sometimes lock up the school, and I would tell them it has nothing to do with your being black. It has to do with your behavior. The way you talk. Black students are still students. They're still beings. They are still human beings. They want the same things. They just didn't have an opportunity to have the background that provided it. So those were the two main things. The gap in the achievement. And it's the curiosity about each other. I thought I knew blacks. I was brought up in Clarendon County and taught in Clarendon County, but I taught at a little white school because they didn't have integration from 39 to 41. White people didn't know what was going on in the black schools. I didn't understand blacks until I worked with them, and as students and as colleagues, we had some wonderful black teachers. We had some who were not good, but we had some white ones who were not good, too.
apart from the racial integration, how did the student body change during the years that you taught?
The student body that I went to in 1960 was not drug addicted. If they used bad language, they used it somewhere else. They seemed to respect their parents. They seemed to respect authority. And during the 1970s, that began to change. The disrespect for authority was one of the biggest things. The lack of motivation to learn. And yet, I think that is not the case now. I've been gone for a long time. It appears to be, from what I read, that children now are really eager to learn. They didn't have to have, 16 units to graduate. Now they have to have 24. They didn't have to take all the tests that they take now. We administered a fair share of tests, but nothing like they have now. We did not have an exit exam when I was there. Some of those things were good, I think, but the biggest change in the change is really in the culture. Our culture doesn't respect people. If you know, the music, the talk shows, those things do not encourage respectful people. So the schools were moving in that direction when I left. But I think they've continued in that direction. I never had any problems with disrespect at all. But I respected them, and they knew it. It's a mutual thing. If you show caring and respect, I believe you will get a better relationship. I won't say it's going to be perfect, but you've got to do that. You've got to show that you respect this child as a person, whether they are bad or good, or whether they're white, black, or whatever. And then you have to respect their cultures. You have to understand that, you have to try to understand them. And it can be done. I'm very, very optimistic about what the schools can do to make human beings good human beings. Who make good decisions. I don't know what we're going to do in our society about greed, but it's very real. This is a materialistic society, and it carries on into the schools, and I don't know what we can do about it.
What do you think have been the causes of the decline in values?
Well, that's a big question. I think the media has had a lot to do with it. We didn't have television. When I was a little girl, I didn't know how the rest of the world lived. Because I even remember when we didn't have radios. And now that children have access to so much that's good and so much that's not good, that I think that has something to do with it. I think that I'm a great believer in And we used to have a devotional in our school every morning. And since I was head of the student council, the president of the student body got on the intercom, and we had a devotional and a prayer every morning. And it usually, most of the time, did not come from the Bible. It came from a lesson that was, and we usually picked something when we wrote it. He and I wrote it together, or she and I wrote it together. And it would just be about a two-minute thing. And if we would pick up something that was happening in the world or something that was happening in the community that we knew everybody knew about, and we took it from there and left with a positive challenge to the students. I don't know how much they listened to it, but I believe that enough did that it was worthwhile, and it only took 2 minutes. You can't do those things because you can't mention God anymore, but you can talk about values. I was in charge of graduation at Greer High School for 15 years, and we had prayer and the speeches that the children wrote, you know, often included allusions to God. And I just don't see anything wrong with that. I can see that there may be some problems with allusions to Jesus Christ, but not, there shouldn't be a problem with God, with a creator. So the third thing I would think in values is that we have a lot of parents who don't seem to care anything about their children. Now, they will buy for them, but there's a whole lot of difference between that and caring about them. We have not taught, and I've thought about this a lot. I taught from 1960 to 1979. So the people that we taught are now parents of even grandparents. And if they're not doing a good job with their families, I keep asking myself, what could we have done to make them better parents? And it has to come through a form of character education and an understanding of what a family is and what family members mean to each other. And I do think that in particularly in the black community, that is improving. I get that the lady who attends, comes out and helps me, is black, and she lives in the black community, and she's worked for me now. For example, she dropped out of school in the ninth grade and had two children with different fathers, never married. Both of her sons are doing well. Her granddaughter is in college. Her one son owns his own business, and the other one has been working at the hospital for 20-some years. So in just that one family, there's been a climbing up, and they have good values, and they value education. We don't really value education a whole lot. We talk about it, but we don't. I taught my first year of teaching. I made $75 a month for 9 months. The next year I made 80. The next year I made 85. Well, the next year I left that school district and went to Rock Hill because they paid better. And also, you know, I'll go back to the fact that I had to quit my job when I got married. When I tell that to people now, they don't believe it. Well, when we really got into the war, and so many men were in the war, and they left wives, they changed policy. But it was forced on them by circumstances, by world circumstances. And I'm not sure that teachers are still are respected now.
Respected by whom?
generally the public. I think the public has, as a whole, has very little understanding of what a teacher's job entails. You know, it's not a 8:30 to 3 o'clock job, and it's and we blame everything on the schools. You know, the schools didn't do this, they didn't do that. So we mouth all these nice things about how we value education, but if we valued education, teachers would start out at twice what they made. Or they might be on probation for a few years and make that. But I'm trying to think of what I made when I left, and I have a master's degree. I really can't remember what I was making. But it never mattered to me because I didn't have to make the living. My husband made the living. See, I was brought up in a generation in which that was what you did. The wife stayed home and had the babies, and the husband made the living. And even when I finished college, there were only four fields that women could go into easily. One was teaching, one was nursing, one was secretarial work. And they to be a CEO, I have a daughter who is president and CEO of a very complex company in California. Even being in an authoritative position in education, we were teachers. And you did that if you worked.
Do you think that's why a lot of women got married so young?
I have a niece who has written a book that's been very well received, and it said, the title of it is, "What is a Smart Woman Like You Doing at Home?" See, I happen to believe that if you have children and you can possibly stay home with them, you should. I did for 17 years, and we didn't have any money. We didn't have any money in the bank, really, until after we got our last child through college. And all of a sudden, you know, we had a little bit of money. But now, everybody wants everything, and they want everything now. I just have been very fortunate because I love my work, and I would have done it for less money, which no feminist would approve of. They would not like my saying that. But teachers should be paid more in accordance with what they do. Our children are our future. How can we feel like the people who have them for the greatest part of the day are not the most important people that they encounter?
I would love to hear also what kind of work you did on the rationing for
war price and rationing.
War price. Yeah.
Well, during the war, so many things were rationed, and you got a little booklet with coupons in it for canned goods and for meats, and you got another little booklet for sugar. But to get tires were rationed, shoes were rationed, gasoline was rationed. All of that had to come through. You had to specifically request that, and it had to come through my office, and we had a war price and rationing board that was over the office. It was a very interesting job. During the war, there may have been a lot of corruption, but I didn't see it. I saw fairness because we were all in it. it was not like the divisive wars that we've had since then. The whole country was, generally speaking, was behind part of World War II. But that was what I did. If you wanted new shoes, if you wanted gas, the standard ration for gasoline was 3 gallons a week. And that was an A1 sticker. You got an A1 sticker that you put on your car. And if you needed more gas than that, you know, traveled, or if you had illness and had to make trips, you had to apply. You had to apply for extra, those three things that I mentioned didn't get books for. And they had to come through my house. So that's what I did. I did that until I married. And, well, wait a minute, I'm mixing things up. I married and did that until my husband was moved, and I moved with him. He was the recruiting officer, naval recruiting officer in Rock Hill. So we were able to stay in Rock Hill, and I kept that job. Also got pregnant first year I was married. Had a baby the first year I was married.
Did your husband ever go overseas with the Navy?
No. He had a very mysterious situation. He was going to be drafted. He was the sole support of his mother. There was no provision in the government to give an allowance for a mother who was a sole support. So he was walking down the street in Rock Hill, and one of his friends came up to him and said, "Gene, I just put your draft notice in the mail." And he said, "What was it to?" And he said, "To the Army." And he didn't want to go in the Army. So he didn't stop walking. He went down to the Naval Recruiting Station and signed up. And he, when they sent him to Columbia to be sworn in, the officer in charge of the Naval Recruiting Office in Rock Hill set a note with him. That man was a retired Navy boilermaker, a water tender, who had always worked below deck on the ship. He didn't know anything about office work, and Gene had been an office manager. And so he said, I send this man back up to me. So Gene was sent to Rock Hill to serve as a recruiter. During the war, they stopped recruiting, and everybody went through an induction station. The induction station, there was one in Spartanburg at Camp Croft, and Gene worked there. We lived in Spartanburg that year, and he represented the Navy on the induction board. The Navy, the Air Force, the Coast Guard, the Marines, they all had to take they had to divide up the draftees. And they weren't allowed, really, to say where they wanted to go. Now, that was after we were well into the war. A board representing all of the services, and Gene represented the Navy, decided who went where. And so he was at the induction station there. Left went there. When they closed that station, he went to Camp Fort Jackson. And we lived in Columbia, and he was the representative there. The war was he was finally issued a sea bag and told to report to San Diego to board ship. He was going to see service duty. I've got a job teaching, and was going to leave my child with my mother, and Truman dropped the bomb. And when Truman dropped the bomb, Gene didn't have, he didn't have to go. So he was in the service for 4 years and never saw the water. Was in the Navy for 4 years, never saw the water. And he didn't ask for that kind of treatment. They just, that's just the way it worked. But my brothers were in it, and they were in it in, over there. In fact, all of my generation was in it. I'm 87, and I finished college in 1939, which was the year that Germany invaded Poland. The Pearl Harbor attack was 1941, so everybody that I knew who wasn't 4F, 4F was that you were physically disqualified, but that was, we were the Depression and World War II generation. And we learned a lot by being that. The Depression taught us to save. It taught us that you didn't have to have, in my family, we never thought of buying anything we couldn't pay for. You didn't. You just didn't do it. And there were seven children, but we had we got along.
What kind of work were your parents in?
My mother was a mother. That was her work. My father was a lumberman, and he, I can tell you this little story. My mother had, she loved children. She was an orphan when she was little, and she loved a family. She wanted a family more than anything. She had been a secretary before she was married. So when I was born, I was the fifth child. Mama had one, two, one, four, one, six, and one, nine. And when I was five, which she had another one, when I was 10, a little baby infant was left on the front porch of a very, not an affluent family in the area where my father worked. And he called my mother and said, don't you have some clothes or something that you can bring over here that'll help out with this thing? And honey, mama went over there and she came back with the baby. And that baby is, we legally adopted her, and she is my sister.
That is so
wonderful story. Six children. And and adopting another one. We all had, we had a family meeting, and we said, what will you give up if we take another child? And my daddy immediately said, he had smoked, and he said, I will give up my cigarettes. I got an allowance of 10 cents a week. And I said, I'll give up my 10 cents. 10 cents would get you in the movie. And when you went to the movie then, you saw the movie, a serial, a comedy, and the news for 10 cents. You could get a Coke and a package of crackers for 10 cents. Coke cost a nickel and a package of crackers cost. You know, people don't have to have everything they think they have to have. It's, I see all these houses that have been built. I don't see any little houses that have been built. They're big houses. In order to keep them, both parents have to work. How can they possibly have a family life? So the difference, our culture has changed a lot. Living together before marriage is no longer frowned upon. It's not necessarily accepted, but it is not frowned upon. All of the entertainers who do the singing and the dancing and the acting and all that, they don't pay any attention to marriage. And those are the people who influence our children. They and those people and the professional athletes. I volunteered in one of the disadvantaged schools after I quit everything else because I could go when I wanted. The reason I volunteered was because a friend of mine who worked there told me, one day she said, "Mary, we have children who come to us who do not know what it means to turn a page. This means they have never had a book in their hand or a paper, newspaper, or a magazine. These are the people who would buy the parents who would buy a six-pack of beer, but not something like that." So I went around to the thrift stores, and I bought over years 4,000 or 5,000 books, and took them to the schools and said, "I want these children to have a book that's theirs." And that's how I started volunteering. And I was in a class one day, and the teacher left the room for a while, and she told me that I could do what I was. She trusted me, and she said, "You can do what you like with it." And I said, "You know, I've seen you all. I'll come down here not the time to see you all. Why don't you draw me a picture of what you would like to be?" And every one of them drew a professional athlete or a performer on television. Everyone. And those are the people who are influencing our children. I know that really made an impression on me. I am not a person who knows everything, but I know that. I know that if children are loved and cared for and made to believe that they matter, it makes a tremendous difference in them. Now, this whole matter of self-esteem bothers me because self-esteem is, I think, misused. You know, we can all be worthy in God's sight, and we're all God's children, but we need to be worthy of something. Now, I would have a lot of my friends who are teachers challenge me on that. Maybe it's just the semantics, this terminology. We can't leave children to raise themselves. They need boundaries. They need discipline. They're not going to thrive without it.